Good morning and welcome to the Justice Hour. I'm your host, Lisa Marie Macy. If you'd like to have a list of upcoming Justice Hour events, special offers, and guests, send me an email at lisa@lisamacy.com and you can get the Justice Hour e-weekly featuring special offers and invaluable insider information. Also, when you have some time, visit my website at www.lisamacy.com. We're live from West Palm Beach, Florida, on the best independent talk radio station in South Florida. You're listening to 1340 AM WPBR, raising the bar with guests from near and afar. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in your car, give me a call and you too will be the star. Our call-in number is 561-641-8256. We're also the only station in South Florida with live video web streaming at talk1340wpbram.com. Joining me today is New York attorney Michael Lesher, co-author of the book, From Madness to Mutiny, which dissects the way the family court system has betrayed children and the parents who try to protect them. Michael will discuss with us today how to manage a custody lawsuit with or without an attorney, along with several other issues relating to the family courts. The time now is 9:07. Now, first, a look at the legal news. We have in the headlines, the Florida porn judge has been named to an appeals panel. After the Sixth Judicial Circuit Court judge, Brant Downey III, admitted to viewing pornographic websites from his courtroom computer, many people in Florida thought he should have been immediately removed from the bench. But instead, the chief judge, David Demers, has, in essence, rewarded him for his misconduct and appointed him to a panel for the next 6 months, which reviews civil appeals, even after his judgment and demeanor have become an issue before the Florida Supreme Court. Although the justices were annoyed that the Florida Judicial Qualifications Commission, the JQC, had dismissed several allegations involving Downey's alleged sexual harassment of female attorneys who appeared before him in various court cases, rather than immediately removing Downey from the bench, they allowed him to retain his position till the end of his term, which would be January 1st, 2007, at which time he'll retire. But they said he won't be able to serve as a senior judge and can't seek reappointment or election as a judge. Now, other judges have criticized Demers' actions, saying that there were other qualified judges, more qualified judges without the baggage of Downey available who could have been appointed. According to a 2005 study conducted by the Pinellas Pasco Public Defender's Office, since the year 2000, Downey has been reversed in 72 cases, more than any other Pinellas criminal judge. With this kind of record, it seems implausible for him to sit on a panel to consider appeals. In other news, we have Yulee, Florida, which apparently is in the northeast corner of the state. An officer with the Nassau County Sheriff's Office has been charged with molesting an inmate in the department's evidence room. Jarrett Wade Hodges, age 36, allegedly asked a 24-year-old male inmate into the evidence room, grabbed him and fondled him, offering to perform oral sex on him. Hodges has been charged with official misconduct, tampering with the evidence, battery, and unnatural and lascivious acts, and is being held on a $100,000 bond. The reports indicate that Hodges was allegedly playing pornographic tapes. You just don't know what's going on in our jail prison facilities during the incident. So the sheriff is playing pornographic tapes and told the prisoner that if he didn't cooperate, he would get in trouble. A pornographic videotape was found in the evidence room, and Hodges admitted to touching the inmate improperly. Apparently, the inmate was wired with a microphone and recorded the incident. Uh-oh. Then when confronted, the sheriff's officer submitted his letter of resignation. Of course, they had it all on tape. Upon being questioned, he admitted that this was not the first time this went on with an inmate. Next, we have Batavia, which I believe is in New York. A town justice angrily and sarcastically berated a defendant, repeatedly referring to his judicial power and asking the defendant, "Don't you know who I am? He's been censored." David Whiter, who was irked because a defendant left a message on the court answering machine threatening to send the defendant to jail over a traffic ticket, albeit he had no authority to do so. He was a traffic magistrate, and he told him, bring a couple $1,000 in bail money. The State Commission on Judicial Conduct concluded that Whiter, a town justice since 1993, had no basis in law to incarcerate a defendant and that his angry threat to do so was grossly inappropriate. On April 6, 2002, David Kazapowski was charged with no front windshield with the traffic ticket returnable on April 22nd. When he didn't appear in court that date or enter a plea by mail, the justice notified the commission of the Department of Motor Vehicles to suspend his driver's license. Kapolsky was advised by DMV that his license had been suspended for failure to answer a ticket, and he would have to appear in the Batavia town court to avoid the suspension. Kazowski telephoned the court, left a message on the court's answering machine asking to be contacted about his ticket, adding that he would file a notice of claim against the town if he was not contacted. Then we have a scorned attorney sues Kiss and Tell website. A Pittsburgh lawyer claims his reputation is being harmed by comments posted by purported ex-girlfriends on a Miami-based website. So he's filed a defamation lawsuit against the site operator and her company in Pennsylvania State Court. On Thursday, plaintiff Todd Hollis sued DontDateEmGirl.com. And if you haven't been to this website, you have to go and check it out. It's hysterical. And the owner and operator, Tasha Joseph, a former South Florida freelance reporter. The suit also names as defendants several women who reportedly posted comments and the company that hosts the website's domain name. The website was launched last year. It was designed as a place for women to post information about the predilections and dispositions of men around the country as a warning to other women who might date them. Apparently, the negative comments about Hollis's character, including one claiming that he has herpes, are false and harmed his professional and personal reputations. But Joseph and the other attorneys say that the suit that Hollis brought will not succeed. They said Congress and the courts have established broad protections for website operators. Apparently, in the suit, Hollis asserts that he is a well-known and highly respected attorney who practices criminal defense law in Pittsburgh. Hollis says he learned the name of a woman who posted a comment about his having herpes and fathering multiple children, which he says are not true. Hollis's lawsuit said he and his attorney asked Joseph to take down the comments, but she refused. He claimed subsequent postings occurred, including one declaring that he was homosexual or bisexual, another saying that he had infected a woman with a sexually transmitted disease, and another complaining about the quality of his home and his clothing. Let me get to our guest. Good morning, Michael Lesher. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you.
I want to tell everyone about, I told them a little bit about your background, but I wanted you to tell them a little bit more. I told them that you are an author and an attorney in New York.
That's right. Actually, I'm calling you from my home in New Jersey, but I'm admitted, as an attorney in New York. I'm a writer. I've written a number of articles, and now I'm co-author of a book with Dr. Amy Neustein called From Madness to Mutiny, Why Mothers Are Running from the Family Courts and What Can Be Done About It, a title which pretty much tells you what the book deals with. It's about how mothers and their children, children who have been sexually abused by a father, have been let down and betrayed by the family court system. I also, as an attorney, provide legal writing and research consultation work for people who are either appearing with another lawyer or appearing pro se, and usually in matrimonial litigation.
Now, you're originally from New Jersey or New York State, Michael?
I am a Georgian by birth, and I kind of miss those summers, to tell you the truth.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And you're a graduate of Brooklyn Law School?
That's right. Yes, I also have a master's degree from the University of Virginia, and have always really thought of myself as a writer first and a lawyer second, which I say sometimes when I call a program like yours, just so people will understand that the lawyer's hat is not on me, because I love everything about our legal system.
And you've been an attorney for quite some time, since 1988, I believe?
I graduated from law school in 88 and was admitted in 89, and actually didn't go into practice right away. I've been doing other things too, including some freelance journalism, And I really got myself involved in legal work through the fact that my freelance journalism led me to deal with cases where, to my astonishment, women who had been in custody litigation with very strong cases suggesting that their children had been sexually abused or physically abused by the other spouse were losing custody. And I first dealt with this as a journalist and then felt that I really had to try to go in and deal with it as a lawyer as well, since I did, after all, have the training and the status to do it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that a lot more, because that is a really big problem in the family courts. Women go in, they complain about abuse, sexual abuse, from the father, and then the judge takes custody away from the mother and gives it to the father. It's incredible.
It can happen a whole lot more often than you would think possible. And other things happen as well. I think it's probably fair to say that most people, and I stress most women, who enter the matrimonial litigation process are really not prepared for what they're going to find when they do enter it. It's usually the first time they've had any serious experience with the court system at all. And the court system that they're now having their first experience with is really a very exceptional system to begin with.
Well, let me tell you something, Michael. I'm an attorney, and I've been practicing for 18 years, and I specialize in family law. And when I went through my own divorce with my ex-husband, and I was very familiar with the family court, I was in no way prepared for what was coming.
Well, that's not surprising. And even if you think you're familiar with it from having been a practitioner, it can really sneak up from behind you and hit you on the head like a sandbag.
You would be shocked at what someone who could do to you and would put you through, who you slept with every night for the past 27 years or however long it's been, who you have children with.
Yes, I think most, again, I'm stressing most women. This can happen to men too, but I find it's more typically a woman's experience. Two things really come as shocking. One is what your marriage and your relationship look like as reflected in the papers of your spouse or soon-to-be ex-spouse once he has dealt with a matrimonial lawyer. That's number one. You don't realize, just because you may have been seeing these papers in other cases without knowing the personal life behind it, what you may not realize is that you're going to be seeing the same kinds of papers as you might if filed against some crazy, vindictive woman. Now that's going to be you. It doesn't really matter what happened. That's the way the papers are going to look anyway. The second thing that's going to catch you by surprise is that you tend to find in family court litigation that everything you were before you entered that litigation really stops being important. You may have thought of yourself as a competent and respected professional. You may have been an attorney. You may have been a matrimonial attorney. But once you walk into court as a party, a matrimonial suit, especially a woman, you are now you're a totally different person, and everything about you, your character, your status in that court, starts to be determined about you by the system according to its own rules, which you may have no understanding of, which may make no sense at all.
That's right. When you're there as a litigant, it is absolutely and totally different than what you go through as being there as an attorney. And I don't think an attorney doesn't fully appreciate the system until they are there as a litigant, and they actually experience the injustice that other people are experiencing. You know, it's very, very different from being on one side of the rope, so to say.
I think that's true, and I think it's not very much different from what many doctors say. How they discovered what medical treatment is like for them when they are patients. It's a very, very different experience.
Yes.
You know, I for example, have worked with one litigant who has a PhD. She had published, had lectured, she'd even lectured judges on some occasions. When she entered family court as a litigant, and I've forgotten if it was her lawyer in some colloquy or something made a reference to her having published these papers, the judge just raised his eyebrows and said something like, this respondent publishes? Forget it. Give me a break. She didn't. As far as he was concerned, she had no history. It didn't really matter. He had already decided what she was.
Yes.
Because of his own approach and his prejudices regarding these kinds of litigations.
Well, Michael, we're going to take a brief break, then we're going to come back, and I want to speak to you some more about the book, Madness to Mutiny,
sure,
and what the reaction has been from judges and other lawyers.
Okay.
Have you been to livingfla.com yet? If you're looking for something new and exciting to do, check out their calendar of events, and what you'll find is a listing of events from Jupiter to the Keys, events for networking, the family, and singles. One upcoming not-to-be-missed event this week is Friday night. Join me and Dick Farrell for a Republican business networking event at Deluxe, 16 East Atlantic Avenue in downtown Del Rey from 6 to 10 p.m. That's this Friday night. We're going to have light food, two-for-one drink specials. Bring your business cards and your friends for a great evening. Partial proceeds will benefit the Republican Party of Palm Beach County. There'll be a DJ spinning the sounds of the 70s, 80s, and top 40s. Admission is $10, but I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you RSVP online at livingfla.com under the tab RSVP and put in GOP at Deluxe in the event line and arrive before 7 p.m. Friday night, the admission will be only $5. I promise you a great time. Now, if you'd like to get away from the traffic and congestion of South Florida and have a relaxing vacation not far from all the local hotspots, why not visit the beautiful beaches of Daytona? There's a whole new world out there long past the days of bikers and spring breakers. And while you're there, I have information about a private beachfront retreat, so have your pen and paper ready. Surf's up! Pack up your Harley and head on up to Daytona for your next vacation. Private oceanfront rentals are now available in Wilbur-by-the-Sea, next to historic Ponce Inlet, 5 miles south of Daytona Beach, 1 hour from Disney World and Kennedy Space Center. Stay in a sunny ocean cottage with private beach access, direct oceanfront, spacious patio, brick grill area, shared washer, dryer, and front parking. Two units are now available in a duplex, which include a totally remodeled efficiency, ocean view, full and complete kitchen, granite countertops, and travertine floor. Sleeps two. Another two-bedroom unit sleeps six and has a full kitchen, satellite TV, non-smoking, convenient to stores, restaurants, and ocean walk in Daytona. Call Nina at 386-322-3582. Tell her you heard about it on the Justice Hour. Rentals are available daily, weekly, or monthly. See pictures on the web at www.cyberrentals.com. Property number 123650.
Hi, this is Rob Seidlecki. I'm running for State House Seat District 85. And while we're on the campaign trail, we always listen to the Justice Hour, hosted by attorney Lisa Marie Macy, every 9 till 10, Monday, on Talk 1340 WPBR, where you're a star.
You're listening to The Justice Hour. I'm your host, Lisa Macy, and with me today is New York attorney and author Michael Lesher. Do you have a question about the family courts? If so, our phone number is 561-641-8256. Michael, let's get back to Madness to Mutiny.
Sure.
Can you tell us some more about what the book is about and about your co-author, Amy Neustein?
Yes, well, Amy Neustein has a most remarkable story. She was, she has a PhD in sociology and had, as a young woman, a married woman with one daughter, had already been speaking in various forums about this her specialty, which really has to do with conversation analysis. Very prominent and upcoming figure in that field. Then, after she got divorced, a few years later, her mother reported seeing the ex-husband molesting the child. And through an amazing process of litigation, which would be too complicated to describe here, she lost custody of the child and ended up being accused of emotional neglect.
So her mother saw her husband molesting their child. Then she went to the court because she thought that she would get the conduct to stop, get protection for the child, correct?
Well, she didn't even have... What happened in this case, strangely enough, remember, they had been divorced already for 3 years. What happened in this case was that the father of the child actually went to court seeking custody after this incident. And
this was a very highly publicized case as well.
That's right. It has been. This is one of the cases that I originally discovered when I began doing general freelance journalism, and this story crossed my desk. Well, after her tragedy in family court and the battle that she's fought for many years to do something about
it. But her husband went to court and saw custody and got it.
Yes, he ended up getting custody. In fact, her visitations were cut off because the child was suffering from severe anorexia. She was 8 years old, and once she was put in the father's custody, she began starving herself.
Oh, dear.
The mother rushed her to a hospital in an effort to save her life. A number of doctors, I believe it was five separate doctors, testified to the severe condition, the fact that she could have died if she hadn't been taken in right away. But the judge said this was a violation of his orders because she had not consulted the father before bringing the child to the emergency room. And although she was lying in a hospital bed with IVs in her arms for 6 weeks, the court cut off the mother's visitation rights on the ground that this was a kind of mistreatment of the child.
Now, they don't. Common sense is not taught in the judicial academy. Isn't that correct?
I'm sorry?
Apparently, common sense is not taught in the judicial college.
Well, you know, perhaps it is, but I don't think it applies very likely. One of the in family courts, one of the reasons that we decided to entitle our book From Madness to Mutiny is that we wanted to stress, and we say in the introduction to the book, that to the outsider, to the uninitiated, what happens in family courts looks literally like madness. Things work in the opposite direction of what you would think they should. Those within the system, that is, the judges, the CPS workers, the law guardians, most of them, there are critics, but most of them within the system don't think that it's a mad system at all.
And CPS is Child Protective Services.
That's right. And they are applying their own kinds of rules to these cases, one of which is that if they think somebody is giving them a hard time, that person tends to become the bad guy in the litigation.
Yeah, and sometimes it may even be filing of an appeal, that they don't like you appealing their decision so that they become known, or maybe going to the press. If they don't like you going to the press and getting media attention, then there's going to be a severe backlash.
Well, that's right. I had a client who not long ago went through a litigation, and one of the things that she alleged had happened was that one of her children had been sexually abused by the father. She had some evidence supporting this. There were also other things happening. Apparently, the children who had a close relationship with her were now all turning against her one by one as they spent more and more time with the father. Well, she eventually went, not to the press specifically, but to Congress. There was a congressional committee looking into issues involving matrimonial litigation, and she gave some testimony. And all she said in the testimony was perfectly true about the things that had happened in her case, which included, by the way, an order signed by the judge, which was literally illegal because it removed the children from her custody without a hearing.
And I've seen that happen locally as well.
That's right. Now, when the word that this had happened got back to the judge, and it got back to the judge because without her knowledge, someone posted some of the testimony that she had given, among other and other people as well, on a website, the judge fulminated against her that by public, because she had mentioned in the course of testifying the names of, I think, one of the children, which she said afterwards really just came out inadvertently. She hadn't even meant to mention the names, but one of them did come out. The judge fulminated that naming this child in testimony to Congress injured the child and showed that she didn't respect the child's well-being. Everything else, what she had to say, the substance of what she had described about how the court had illegally removed the kids and how the kids, one of the children may have been abused and the courts weren't doing anything about it.
Yeah, that didn't harm the child, but her testifying to Congress somehow did harm the child, according to the judge.
That's right. The fact that she had testified, the fact that she had named a child, it's not very hard to see through that kind of pretense and suspect that these people really object to having their role publicized, because confidentiality rules generally protect them from that kind of disclosure. And they get good and mad.
Absolutely.
When litigants break through the veil.
Yes.
It happened in another case that I've been working on, in which the mother did go to the press, and that was exactly what the judge attacked her for.
I've seen the same thing happen in my practice as well. Now, what has the reaction been to your book? Have you gotten any feedback from judges or from other family law attorneys?
Well, the reaction so far generally has been very kind. We've been very pleased with the reviews that have come out. And by the way, if you want to, instead of having me try to go through and list them, I'll remember them. They can all be found through my website, by the way, which is michaellesher.com, something that I would love people to check if they're interested in the work I do generally. But and a couple of the reviewers, and Kim Sloat was one there, some of them have been attorneys. I should probably mention, though, that on the other side of the coin, before the book even came out, there was an effort, apparently an effort, by a man who used to be a law clerk for a family court judge and still maintains a close relationship with that judge, who is still a judicial hearing officer in matrimonial matters, to prevent us from publishing it. He essentially threatened litigation if we did not let his former judge read the book before it was published.
So did you let the judge read the book?
Oh, no. No, certainly not.
And then they didn't sue afterwards. Isn't that amazing that someone would even have the nerve to contact you?
No, but there was a lawyer's letter that went to our publisher.
You should have put that letter into the book.
Well, maybe in a subsequent edition we will. I don't know, but I think that is I don't want to make it any more than it really was. But there is very much still the old guard in family court among the judges, among the people who work for the judges, that essentially regard themselves as a kind of entity unto themselves that resist attack from anyone and everyone outside, even their own colleagues. One thing that's mentioned in the book is that when there was a particular family court judge in New York State who was actually New York City, who was reasonably well known for challenging the positions taken by CPS in court. When Child Protective Services would come in and say, these children have to be removed, or this or that, or, you know, we've already removed them, we want the court's approval.
And based on the competency of the CPS DCF workers, that's certainly legitimate coming from the judge.
It's absolutely legitimate, and in fact, based on my experience, I'd say more than legitimate. I think that unless these people are...
And really required, yes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen petitions that, without going into a lot of detail, they'll curl your hair because they're just clearly wrong.
And the problem with the courts, the juvenile court system, is so many of these judges just rubber stamp and take whatever is brought forward from the government workers, the so-called child protection services, is valid on its face.
Correct. Most do. And now this judge did not. That was his reputation. Now what happened was when he came up for reappointment in the most unusual step, because there was no evidence of any incompetence or any misconduct on his part, he was not reappointed. And an article in the New York Law Journal said quite clearly, and they quoted lawyers saying, that's because this guy stood up to CPS, and CPS made it known to those who were responsible for the reappointment that they didn't want him on the bench, and they were actually able to get rid of him. Which, in a sense, means the tail wags the dog to some extent. Here was a fellow who's even a judge.
That's a disgrace.
I'm sorry?
That's a disgrace that something like that would happen.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, so that dispels the notion of the so-called separation of powers.
To a considerable extent. It shows how collegial, how, if you don't mind the word, incestuous,
yes,
the family court system really is, that it would appear that CPS, because they were unhappy with this judge, not because he had made mistakes, never been reversed, but because they were unhappy with him, were able to create a kind of buzz within the system that said, in effect, this is a bad judge, and get him removed, which tells you, you know, this is a system in which everyone's looking over his shoulder at everyone else, and the last thing they want is someone from the outside challenging them.
Now, Michael, you... and Amy Newstein have been very involved. You're both part of the Orthodox Jewish community?
That's right.
And you wrote some articles about how does the Jewish community sacrifice victims of sexual abuse?
Yes.
And how has that, have you seen that come into the picture?
Well, yes, and I'll tell you, it's a changing picture. Change is slow and it's painful, but I'm pleased to see it happening. The very fact that this article was published at all, I think, was a big step forward. And not long ago, New York Magazine, a major magazine published out of New York, ran an article on a case in which an Orthodox Jewish rabbi was accused of having sexually abused some of his students. I was a source for that story, and Amy Newstein, the co-writer, was quoted in it. And this article actually got very favorable responses, if the letters are any indication, from many members of the Orthodox community generally. I think this represents something of a sea change in that community, because it has been traditionally a community that was more concerned about the use of the word sex abuse anywhere than it was really about trying to stop it.
You think they're trying to keep things quiet. And I don't think that this is confined to the Jewish community. I think that in most religious communities that happens, that they don't, if there is sex abuse, especially coming from within the family, they do not encourage people to go to the prosecutor's office or to take this public. They encourage them to keep it quiet. Same thing with the you know, we have the whole situation with the priests and the sexual abuse there, where they wanted to confine that and take care of that within the church and keep it quiet.
Right. They typically see themselves, and I can't really comment with very much authority about the Catholic community, but certainly within the Orthodox community, the institution of the community itself and its family structure and the institution of the rabbinate that was involved were both considered so important, so sacrosanct, that to sully their reputation in the larger world was just felt to be unacceptable, unthinkable. And I think, honestly, that a lot of the important figures within the community were genuinely ignorant about sex abuse issues, and were so shocked to hear the allegation raised in the first place that it was hard for them really even to consider applying a rational assessment to these things and deciding whether they really happened or not. Certainly, over the years, the approach has usually been that either no one talks about it, or if someone talks about it, it's the person talking about it who is the bad person. Now, that, as I said, is beginning to change. There have been a couple of very highly publicized cases. There was a case against Rabbi Baruch Lanner, a prominent educator in an important Orthodox organization, who has now gone to jail over charges of sexually abusing some of his students. And what came out in that story was that allegations about this person had been made within the Orthodox community for years, actually over a decade, and had generally been covered up. Because that came to the fore, the Orthodox Union, the organization really responsible for this, set up a commission and came out with a number of recommendations for how they should handle things differently. And I think we are starting to see some change, at least change in attitude.
Well, that's a good thing, that if we see some change for the positive. Michael, we're going to take a break for a moment and hear from some of my biggest fans, and then we'll be back to hear your tips on what to do when you're involved with custody litigation. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, this is Lisa Macy,
Sarah Macy,
and Ginger Macy.
Some confuse power with goodness and mistake law for justice,
but not our mom.
Listen to the Justice Hour, Mondays 9 through 10 a.m. on WPVR,
where you're a star.
You're listening to the Justice Hour. I'm your host, Lisa Macy, and with me today is New York attorney and author Michael Lesher. Do you have a question about the family courts? If so, our phone number is 561-641-8256. Michael, now, getting back to the custody litigation, what do most litigants not know about the family court systems that they should know?
Well, the first thing they don't know is that when they enter it, they're going to find themselves subject to an unusual set of rules. I think, for example, and here I'm speaking of matrimonial litigation that involves custody. That's typically where I'm getting involved. So let's assume there's custody at stake. Most people assume that when they speak to a custody evaluator, or when they speak to the judge, or when they speak to other people associated with the case, that if they say, I want to have custody of these children because, look, I've been their primary caretaker for the last 10 years since they were born, I'm a good mother, I know how to care for them. And as for that guy, boy, you know, he's got a list of problems. He's never home. I don't know what he's doing half the time. He's got some habits that really worry me. There's even been verbal abuse or perhaps other things going on in the marriage. They think if they relate this to these people, the decision will be very quick and natural. They will get custody. That's not how it works.
It's not true.
One of the first things they have to know is that they're walking into a system that has its own kind of rules for evaluating these things. For example, as you probably know very well from your own practice, though there is no real rule to this effect written anywhere, most family courts operate according to what lawyers tend to call the friendly parent rule. That is to say, all through the country, family courts tend to favor joint custody arrangements today. And
right. In Florida, they call it shared parenting, but it's the same basic premise.
Same basic premise, which is that it's best for children to have two parents, and that if parents are going to split, they should try to work together in all matters affecting the welfare of the child, because that, all other things being equal, will probably benefit the child. I have my doubts about the theory in general, but certainly with respect to certain kinds of situations, it is clearly inapplicable, because if there is deep conflict between the parents, making them joint custodial, giving them both joint custodial authority certainly is not going to help.
It doesn't work. It just doesn't work.
It doesn't work, and it doesn't fool the kids. The kids know that whoever is taking care of them and living with them for the most part is effectively their parent. What it really does is to create all kinds of problems for the future and plenty of work for lawyers. But that being the case, one of the first things that all these family court personnel will look for is, which is the parent that's standing in the way of that goal? This pie-in-the-sky idea that we're all going to get together, we're all going to get along and be happy and parent this child together, who is it who is coming into court saying things that will prevent us from doing that? If you're the one saying that, you're probably going to find yourself, before things have even got rolling, to be considered the problem parent. So if you're a mother going into court saying, I'm the mother of these kids and I want to keep them because I want to protect them from this weirdo over there, you may find that before anyone has actually listened to what you had to say, you've already been labeled the troublemaker.
Yes. And when we say it doesn't work, I mean, there are, certainly are situations where people can agree and they get along fabulously after the divorce. But
oh,
then
there are.
When that has to be imposed on you from a court, when there was just, you know, problems in the past, it doesn't work. No matter what that court order says, it is not going to change the way two people deal with each other or the entire history of their marriage and their background together.
No, it won't. And what's even worse is that once that has been imposed on the parties and you come back to court saying, Your Honor, get us out of this. We can't work this way because he did X, Y, Z, you again can find yourself not getting the relief you seek, but on the contrary, being criticized for it. It becomes a very difficult game, something that I work very closely with my clients on, a kind of tightrope act, exactly how to position yourself so that on the one hand you can get your concerns heard, but at the same time do not present yourself as the problem parent. And this is something that very few people know they're going to have to deal with when they enter this process.
And this is another problem when we get to the next issue about how to deal with abuse-related issues, because time and time again, when we see the parent going in and complaining about inappropriateness, possible sexual abuse and possible physical abuse in the past, the courts almost look at that parent and they say, well, in their mind, the court, the custody evaluator, this becomes the unfriendly parent.
That's right. And again, it helps enormously to know in advance what you are actually going to encounter. Women, and again, I keep concentrating on women, I have dealt with men as well, but typically this is a woman's problem, a woman's perspective. Women in divorce are usually emotionally agitated to begin with. If they're in a divorce or a post-divorce proceeding and they suspect abuse, they are highly emotional. They are usually not in a state to walk into an interview in a calculating frame of mind and to think through how to come out of the interview looking as much like an impeccable, irreproachable citizen as possible. That's not on their minds at all. They want to spill out everything that's on their minds, including things that, without their having the least idea of it, can actually do them a lot of harm.
And that's great. That's the worst thing they could do.
Because
I mean, you don't want to confide in these people, the custody evaluator, the forensic expert, the coin-appointed expert.
I mean, yes, that's right. And they're not your friends. They're not paid to be your friends. And it can be quite astonishing to see what you said to them put back on paper in the context of the way. And I don't even mean this to be the case for evaluators who really are, and there are some evaluators who really are not doing their jobs and are really, really guilty.
They're doing a harm to families, in fact.
Yes, there are such. But even if they're not, even people who are really just trying to do their jobs as they see them, it's still a mistake to be uncalculating, to not to know what you're facing when you speak to them, because part of their job is to find things to criticize. And if, in the course of describing what looked to you like very worrisome signs of possible abuse, you present yourself as being absolutely, irreconcilably hostile to this father, that is a fact that can come back to haunt you later on, especially if it's not possible to prove to the standard the court will accept the concerns that you presented. Because that they may not prove, but the fact that you're mad as hell they can prove. And being mad as hell in family court is not a good thing.
Now, how do you prepare for custody litigation? What do you tell litigants to do in preparation when they know that there's going to be a custody case up ahead?
Well, first of all, not to blow my own horn, but I really do suggest that they speak to me or someone like me who can give them the kind of counseling step by step in advance that they really are going to need to have. Very few of these people have even heard terms like parental alienation syndrome or Munchausen syndrome by proxy. And they better know going in what to watch out for if evaluations go in that direction. Another thing that I think they really have to...
And isn't it so much better once someone actually does prepare before they go into court, because they'll have all their ducks in a row and all of a sudden they're not suddenly confronted with that. And anyone who files for a divorce nowadays, even if they think, oh, well, my husband and I, we just get along fabulously, I always tell them, I said, do not be surprised that once that paper comes back, that they're going to want custody of your child.
That's correct, or they'll say they do. You know, I don't want to give I don't want to share now all the ideas I have on this side, but in state after state, for example, we have moved over to systems that make no presumption with respect to custody and which allow for equitable distribution of assets.
And the presumption, and that's just such a farce. Why isn't there a presumption that the person who has taken care of the child, who's been the primary caregiver for the past 10 years, they don't have the there's not a presumption that they take care of the child in the future. It's an absolute farce that occurs.
I'm glad you said that, Lisa, because this is one of my bugbears. There are a lot of reforms I'd like to see made in the family court system, but one I would really love to see is for states to adopt a general rule that there should be a rebuttable presumption, that whoever has been the primary caretaker of the children in question should be awarded custody pursuant to divorce. And you can then set up a set of statutory guidelines for how you determine what primary caretaker would be. And everyone asks when you say this, well, but aren't there cases in which that will be in doubt? Sure there will. But I'll bet that I would guess in over three-quarters of the cases that will come to the courts, without any serious question, it will be easy to say this was the primary caretaker.
Yeah, because frequently what you see is all of a sudden, and just say that typically, more likely than not, it is the mother who is the primary caregiver, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this father comes in to court, and they want custody, and they've never taken the child to a doctor's appointment, they've never gone to one school event, they're hardly ever home, they're traveling on business, they're gone from early in the morning to late at night, and then they come into court. And I can't imagine why this judge would sit there and say, they don't say something like, okay, so you haven't been around for the past 10 years. Now, all of a sudden, you filed for divorce where you want to be involved with the child's life or on the record so that you could get some financial incentives now out of it. it's ridiculous.
That's right. What I wanted to mention when I started describing equitable distribution before is that one of the reasons that lawyers, they won't say this on the record, but many did acknowledge this informally in the study that Karen Winter did in New York State, is that they will say, look, put in a request for custody or for joint custody on the theory that this is going to scare the living daylights out of the mother, who may think, now, either I'll lose custody of my children entirely, or maybe I'll have to spend the rest of my life negotiating every decision over this child with this impossible person, and then I'll remove it later if you give me a more favorable financial settlement.
Yes.
That is a...
It's leverage.
Yeah. You can't give people in very contentious adversarial litigation tools that will give them leverage over people and not expect them to use them. And that's what this is. That's one reason. Another reason is that, believe it or not, it really can. People can get vindictive enough to want to take custody just as a way of getting back at a spouse, and they will sometimes get it. I just had a just been consulted this week, that is at the end of last week, by a litigant who's she has always had sole custody of the children, and that was apparently never under at least sole physical custody. It was never challenged before. But an issue just arose where I think she missed a visit, or they rescheduled the visit or something. Anyway, the father is claiming he didn't get notice of this. So he's made a motion for contempt, and in the course of this contempt motion, he has said, and now I want a forensic evaluator appointed, and I want custody. Now, this could be nothing more than a temporary ploy, but one can't be sure.
And you know, whenever these evaluators get appointed, that's trouble in
well,
the case.
Yes, it usually
you,
is.
You know, I usually, and typically when I'm handling a custody case, I will always object to any of these third parties coming in. Not only is it trouble for the family and for the child, but financially it's devastating to the litigation as well. Because these people usually charge $200 on up an hour.
They do. And if you don't like the work they did, it's even more expensive to try to get it undone. In addition, the lawyers are charging money, which is a very, very a point very relevant to what I've been trying to offer when I do workshops called How to Manage a Custody Lawsuit With or Without a Lawyer. One of the things that I have to point out right at the start is, if you're in an ordinary middle-class divorce with ordinary middle-class assets and at least one child, at least around here, without a second thought, legal fees can easily run into the six figures between the two of you, even if you're not unusually contentious.
It's the same thing here in Florida.
Yeah, I don't think I'm exaggerating.
Yes.
That's the way it goes. And when you add to the legal fees the fees of the forensic evaluator, the fees of a law guardian, if a law guardian is appointed for the child, and other witnesses that you've got to bring in for one reason or another, the cost is just overwhelming.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous because at least with, you know, when you involve your children, I mean, everyone out there, that most people will say, I don't care what it is. If the issue is my child, I will spend everything that I have. I will lose everything that I have if that's what it takes. And that's essentially what the courts, what position they put you into when custody becomes an issue.
Well, it is. And by the time it's over, you may realize or suspect that custody was never really the goal. But you've been put under such financial pressure,
yes,
such emotional pressure, that by the time the other side is ready to say, okay, here's a settlement offer, sign it, you're really ready to sign it, even though the offer is in many respects distinctly unfavorable. Again, I don't think I'm exaggerating. One after another, my clients come to me after, I'm often involved in post-divorce or appellate litigation, and they say, you know, I ask them, why did you sign this thing? And they'll tell me, I was broke. I had to refinance my house. I sold everything I had. I was getting fired from my job because I wasn't there enough. And the courts were doing nothing. We were 3 years into the litigation, and nothing serious had been done. We weren't even officially divorced yet.
Yes.
Some judges will tell you, I will not divorce you until we resolve all issues, including custody and financial settlement. And that can be devastating in itself.
Now, going to fight a custody battle without a lawyer, do you actually recommend that to people out there?
No, I don't recommend it. I don't really recommend it to anyone. But I do have to say it is an option. Many clients are coming to me in a position where they really can't do it any other way. And I'll tell you two reasons that can happen. One reason is financial. They've been in the battle too long. They've already spent everything they have. They just can't pay anymore. They've got nothing else. The other reason is that they've been through attorneys, very often more than one. And for various reasons, one after the other attorney is telling them, I'm not going to represent your case the way you want it represented. Again, something that you're not used to if you don't know the system. Most people assume their attorneys are going to follow any instructions they give them, unless they're asking for something illegal.
Now, can you give our listeners, Michael, three things to avoid? Say they are involved in custody litigation, or they anticipate being involved in it. What are the three most important tips that you would give to avoid?
Well, okay, let's see if I can come up with three precise. Number one has to be avoid ignorance. You must be informed. You must find a way, whether it's working with someone like me or going to the books, whatever it is, find out something about the system you're dealing with. You should not be ignorant of the rules, And you should not be ignorant of the process. And that brings me to suggestion number two, which is don't be passive. If you want to work with a lawyer, and generally you should, there are reasons why people can't, but generally you should try to. But initially, right away, when you meet that lawyer, make sure you understand certain things. Is that lawyer going to share with you copies of everything that goes in and out of his office? Again, most people take it for granted this will be true. In matrimonial litigation, you can't. I've had people who've never been allowed to see the forensic reports on themselves. They don't know all the correspondence that's gone back and forth. In my view, you've got to know that. Will that lawyer make settlement offers without telling you in advance? Will he receive or listen to settlement offers? Will he negotiate off the record without your being there and without your knowing he'll do that? Again, I suspect what I'm saying is not unfamiliar to you, but it is unfamiliar to most litigants coming into the process. You've got to ask your lawyer right off, will she do that? If she's going to do that, you've got to know it. And 9 times out of 10, I would say, if that's going to be her approach, you don't want that lawyer.
Absolutely. Now, also, a lot of people don't realize that there are attorneys out there who are available on a consulting basis, that they will, just for a fee that's not as high as them getting involved in litigation, will review an agreement or contract before they sign it, or who they could speak to before agreeing to a stipulation in court, because those things have just profound effects, that once that agreement is signed or once something is agreed to, that it's so much more, so difficult to get it undone afterwards.
That's right, and I guess that's my third tip. Know your options. And here again, I guess I have to plug myself just a bit, but here's the sort of thing that I do, and it can run a wide range of options depending on the client. As you say, you can bring someone in without actually being represented by an attorney in court or being represented by another attorney. You can have someone say, before I sign this, I'd like you to look at it. You can have someone say, you know, my lawyer says he doesn't have time to deal with every phone call, every letter, every email I get from this lunatic that I'm litigating against, but someone's got to. And I, by the way, I fully agree with that. I think that if you don't watch those things, they can pile up and catch you from behind eventually in the course of motion practice. So I like to review everything that goes in and out between my clients and their spouse or ex-spouse. A lot of lawyers just don't have the time to do that. Someone can do it. Or someone can come in, and again, this is sort of the big option in the kind of work I do, and draft the papers. Do all the research. Follow the case. Keep up with it. But not actually go into court. Not deal with the judges and other attorneys in conferences. Not pay a receptionist, the secretary, a paralegal, everything else that lawyers pay. And therefore can charge you a whole lot less money and yet get you a very professional legal product to enable you to go into court and handle yourself effectively. You know,
Michael, I hate to interrupt you, but I want to wrap up.
Oh, sure.
You've been listening to the Justice Hour. Thank you to all our listeners, and thank you so much, Michael Lesher, for being our guest today. Michael, if you want to give our listeners your website, email address, telephone number that you can share in the event that they have questions and they want to get some more information.
Absolutely. The best way to contact me really is through my website, which is michaellesher.com. michaellesher.com, and you can contact me by email directly through the site, or you can email me at mlesher@att.net. That's generally the best way to reach me. You also, by going to the website, learn something about the work I do.
And if someone's interested in buying the book, From Madness to Mutiny?
The book is available through Barnes & Noble. I'm not sure what other book chains have it, but I know it is available through Barnes & Noble, and the publisher is the University Press of New England. And they can also be contacted online if you can't find it anywhere else.
Okay, great. And other upcoming events, we have breakfast after the show at Newport Cafe, Forest Hill Boulevard, between Congress and Florida Mango. Next week, my special guest will be syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker. Her column appears in more than 300 papers across the country. Parker's many awards for her incisive commentary include Best Columnist from the Florida Society of Newspaper Editors. Parker's column focuses on social issues related to family, children, and gender. Having grown up in Florida with 4 stepmothers and a variety of siblings, half, step, and whole, Parker says, "I know of what I speak." Don't miss it. God bless, and have a wonderful week. And keep listening to the Justice Hour.